Welcome back to Jacko's Stackology, where we talk about concepts in neuroscience and psychology. This is the first of a multi-part series covering clinical neuroanatomy. Throughout this series, I will be referencing the book Clinical Neuroanatomy, the 29th edition, written by Stephen G. Waxman. A lot of this information is very complicated and can be a little bit difficult to digest. So I will try to simplify things as much as I can wherever I can. But in this first section, I'd like to go over some basic principles, primarily covering the fundamentals of the nervous system. So why is an understanding of the nervous system important? Well, a working knowledge of neuroanatomy is essential to all clinicians. Your nervous system controls not only your thought processes, but also the rest of your body. Your movement and your ability to sense the world around you rely on your nervous system. That being the case, the central nervous system is the most complex existing computational device. So your brain is a computer, and it's the best computer that is known to exist in the universe. Humans have tried to replicate it and failed miserably. Even the most advanced technology today fails in comparison to the brain's ability to do the same things and make it look simple. So the brain receives and interprets a wide array of sensory information. It controls various simple and complex motor behaviors, engages in deductive and inductive logic. The brain can imagine, plan ahead, make complex decisions, think creatively, and even feel emotions. So we take a lot of this for granted. We don't really think about this too often. But you're able to walk down the street and pull out your cell phone because you feel the vibration. You look down and you see you got a text from your friend. You read this text and you process that information and come up with a reasonable reply. And you're looking down at your phone while you're still walking and you type this reply in just as you're about to step off of a curb. But you can simultaneously listen for a car that's coming by. Before crossing the street, you stop yourself, wait for the car to get by, look both ways, and then cross, still typing away on your phone. And you can do all of this with a fair amount of ease, but good luck creating a robot that can do that same thing. So, although these things seem simple, when you try to replicate them, it's very difficult to make a piece of machinery do what you're able to do and make it look so easy. The brain does all sorts of wild things. For instance, it can generalize and it possesses the ability to recognize things, and that ability to recognize things can't be reproduced even by advanced computers. For instance, how you're able to look at your friend and you notice their familiar face regardless of what angle their face is at. The brain also carries out many of these tasks nearly simultaneously. So it's important to note that the complexity of the nervous system is dynamic and it's a network of interlinked computers. In reality, the computer is like having multiple computers that are all made for different purposes and linking them all up so that they can act as one machine. This anatomy can be readily learned and understood. Different parts of the brain and spinal cord work to provide different functions. This allows for a clinician to make a relatively acute prediction about potential sites of dysfunction based on clinical history and a careful neurological examination. For instance, if a person has trouble with speech production, typically we know that speech is processed by the left hemisphere in the temporal lobe. And so if you see somebody having trouble with their production of speech, you might scan their brain and look at the left temporal lobe to see if there's any sort of damage, perhaps a lesion, or maybe they've suffered a stroke. So clinical neuroanatomy is essential for understanding of disorders and the nervous system. That being said, there's a lot to cover here. And we can get muddied in a lot of different definitions. One thing that can be helpful is to try to map the brain or to understand it in segments. In reality, everyone's brain is different, and trying to look at these main divisions can be difficult because they often overlap with one another. So the use of these structural and functional maps helps to provide us with a tool to base our judgment off of, but these are not definite structures. So looking at the main divisions of the brain, we can think of it in terms of either anatomy or function. In terms of anatomy, the nervous system has two parts. The first part is the central nervous system, oftentimes abbreviated CNS, and that's comprised of the brain and the spinal cord, and it's enclosed completely in bone and wrapped in meninges, which are a sort of protective flesh, and fluid-filled spaces. The second part of the anatomical structure of the nervous system is the peripheral nervous system, abbreviated PNS, which is formed by the cranial and spinal nerves. These are nerves that come out from the brain to the face and to the body, as well as nerves that come out from the spine to the rest of the body. But we don't just talk about the nervous system in terms of anatomy. We also talk about the nervous system in terms of function. So when looking at the nervous system in terms of function, we can look at two different aspects of function. The first one is the somatic nervous system, which innervates the structures of the body wall. You can think of this being your muscles, your skin, and your mucous membranes. And then you also have the autonomic or the visceral nervous system, often abbreviated ANS, which contains portions of the central and peripheral systems. It controls the activities of the smooth muscle and glands of the internal organs or the viscera and the blood vessels and returns sensory information from these organs back to the brain. As for the structural units and the overall organization, the brain and the spinal cord make up the central portion of the nervous system, which is why we call them the CNS, or the central nervous system. And the brain can be further subdivided or further broken into smaller sections known as the cerebrum, the brainstem, and the cerebellum. The most rostral part, or the part that's closest to the front, is the cerebrum. The cerebrum, or the forebrain, as it's also known, is the most phylogenetically advanced and responsible for most complex functions, such as cognition. The brainstem, the medulla, and the spinal cord, though essential, are less advanced in function. Furthermore, the cerebrum, or the forebrain, can be separated into two smaller sections. One is the telencephalon, and the other is the diencephalon. The telencephalon makes up the cerebral cortex, which is the most highly evolved part of the brain, which we colloquially refer to as gray matter. The telencephalon also includes the subcortical white matter, which is named for the appearance of the highly lipid-rich myelin content of myelinated fibers. Basically, that means that you're looking at the axons of the neurons, and they're coated in a layer of fat to help insulate them. This doesn't contain the neuronal cell bodies or the synapses. The telencephalon also holds the basal ganglia, which is a set of structures, these gray masses deep within the cerebral hemispheres. And then we have the diencephalon, which includes the thalamus and the hypothalamus. So these are a bunch of terms, and this might seem like too much right now, but I want to assure you that over time we're going to go over each one of these structures specifically and their own functions in depth. Next, we'll talk about the brainstem, which includes the midbrain, also known as the mesencephalon, the pons, and the medulla oblongata. We also have the cerebellum, which consists of the vermis and the two lateral lobes, but we'll talk more about each one of these structures much later. Let's talk about functional units. The brain accounts for approximately 2% of the body's weight and contains many billions of neurons and glial cells. These neurons, or nerve cells, are specialized cells that receive and send signals to other cells through their extensions known as nerve fibers, or axons, like I was talking about before. This information that they receive is then processed and encoded in a sequence of electrical or chemical steps that occur very rapidly. Many neurons have relatively large bodies and really long axons that transmit impulses quickly over a considerable distance. However, it's important to note that there's a specific type of neuron that we refer to as interneuron. These have smaller cell bodies and very short axons, and they tend to transmit impulses locally between other neurons that are close by. For some more vocabulary, nuclei are grouped bundles of nerve cells serving a common function, often with a common target. So you have the neuron, which is a single cell, consists of a cell body, dendrites, and an axon. When you have a bunch of these neurons grouped together and they receive similar information and they also have a common target, we refer to these groupings as nuclei. Ganglia are nerve cells that are grouped together with common form, function, and connections, which are formed outside of the CNS. So we're referring to nuclei when we're talking about within the brain and spinal cord. And when we are talking about outside of the brain and spinal cord into the other organs, then we're referring to ganglia. Another functional unit that we have are known as glial cells, which are other cellular elements that support the activity of neurons. There are many types of glial cells. They're usually very small. They can do things like provide nutrition, metabolic support, or structural function. But for the sake of simplicity, we'll just refer to them as glial cells. It's important to note that glial cells, these support cells, outnumber neurons 10 to 1. Next, let's talk about information processing in the nervous system. So here's another term, synapse. Synapses are where nerve cells convey chemical messenger signals to one another. You have one neuron that is sending out a neurotransmitter signal, and another neuron is receiving that neurotransmitter signal. And that location where those two neurons are communicating across this gap is known as a synapse. But we're going to talk more about that process later. For now, let's talk about neurotransmitters. Neurotransmitters, or chemical transmitters, are associated with the function of the synapse, and they provide a signal that is either excitatory or inhibitory, depending on that synapse. A neuron may receive thousands of synapses bringing information from many sources. Each neuron acts as an information processing device by integrating the excitatory and inhibitory inputs from diverse sources to provide its own message. So you have a bunch of neurons that are all firing at their own rate. They're all providing their own neurotransmitters, and they're converging on the same neuron. And this same neuron is receiving either excitatory or inhibitory input from all the other neurons that are sending messages to it. And it integrates all this positive and negative information and determines whether or not it will fire to its target. Another term is monosynaptic chain, which is the most simple connection between two neurons by a single synapse. These mediate very primitive behaviors, such as reflex and unconscious contraction of the muscles around the knee in response to percussion of the patellar tendon. So if you've ever been at the doctor and they brought that little tiny hammer out and they hit you on the knee with it and your leg jerks, that's because of this very simple monosynaptic chain. A polysynaptic neural circuit includes many neurons that are interconnected by synapses. This is when we have sometimes very highly complex chains of neurons intercommunicating with one another. And they tend to mediate more complex behaviors. Let's talk about tracts and commissures. So another important term is to know what a fasciculus is. Fasciculus, or fasciculi, plural, are tracts in the form of fiber bundles which act as pathways between groups of neurons in the central nervous system. We also have columns, sometimes referred to as funiculi, and they are aggregates of these fasciculi, as seen in the spinal cord. These tracts may descend or ascend, depending on what kind of information they're conveying. We refer to them as descending when they move information from the cerebrum to the spinal cord. Or we refer to them as ascending when they're moving information from the spinal cord to the cerebrum. These pathways are vertical and may cross or decussate from one side of the central nervous system to the other. Commissures are horizontal or lateral connections. So an interesting general theme in neuroanatomy is that the nervous system is constructed with what's known as bilateral symmetry. This is most apparent in the cerebrum and the cerebellum, which are organized into left and right hemispheres. Although some higher cortical functions, like language, are represented more strongly in one hemisphere than the other, the hemispheres have similar structure. Even more caudal structures that are not organized into hemispheres, such as the brainstem and the spinal cord, also look to have bilateral symmetry. Decussation and crossed representation is a general theme that neuroanatomists use to describe the crossing of a fiber tract from one side of the nervous system to the other. The right side of the brain receives information about and controls motor function pertaining to the left side of the world, and vice versa. Information about the right field of vision is processed in the visual cortex on the left side of the brain. Sensation of heat, touch, and joint position on the right side of the body are all processed in the left somatosensory cortex. There are exceptions to this rule that still make functional sense. For instance, the left sternocleidomastoid muscle is controlled by the left cerebral cortex. As a result of its unusual biomechanics, contraction of the left sternocleidomastoid rotates the neck to the right. So, in most instances, you have the right hemisphere controlling the left side of the body, the left hemisphere controlling the right side of the body. However, in this instance, if you want to move your head to the right, you need to use the right side of your brain to move the left side of your neck. So you have the left side of your brain talking to the left side of your neck, but the ultimate function moves the head right. So even functionally, it makes sense, even though we've sort of broken the rule. Therefore, control of movements relevant to the right side of the world originate in the contralateral left hemisphere, as predicted by the principle of crossed representation. So one major exception to the rule of crossed motor control is that as a result of the organization of cerebellar inputs and outputs, each cerebellar hemisphere controls coordination and muscle tone in the ipsilateral side of the body. But we'll talk more on that later. You just heard me use a lot of big words, and it's important that we understand the definitions for these words. For instance, you heard me say contralateral. For those who do not know, contralateral refers to the opposite side. So when I'm talking about my right and left arm, I can say that they're contralateral to one another. But when I'm talking about my right arm and my right leg, I would say that they are ipsilateral to one another, which means that they're on the same side of the body. There are also maps of the world within the brain. These sort of representations of what's going on in your external environment are recorded and interpreted inside of the brain. Your own brain has a representation of what's going on. So on many levels, the brain maps various aspects of the outside world by containing some kind of representation. For example, the dorsal columns carry sensory information about touch and vibration from the body's surface upward within the spinal cord. Axons within the dorsal columns are arranged in an orderly manner, with fibers from the arm, the trunk, and the leg forming a map that preserves the spatial relationship of these body parts. A sensory map also exists in the sensory cortex in the cerebral hemispheres, which has the form of a small distorted human, which we call a homunculus. So basically what that means, to put that a little more simply, you have a somatosensory cortex, and this cortex maintains a representation of where your body is at in three-dimensional space relative to itself. And you have a spot in your brain that perceives the sensation of touch for your fingertips, and a spot that perceives the sensation of touch for your palm. And on your body, your fingers and your palm are right next to each other. And in your brain, the representation of where your fingers are at and the representation of where your palms are at are also next to each other. There are multiple maps of the visual world within the occipital lobes and the temporal and parietal lobes. These maps are called retinotopic because they preserve the geometrical relationship between objects imaged on the retina and thus provide special representations of the visual environment within the brain. Basically, when you look out into your field of vision and see a tree, the image, the light bouncing off that tree, provides an image of a tree that falls on your retina. And there will be a part of that tree that is the trunk, and a part of that tree that is the top of the tree. And there will be a part of the tree that's the middle. And when you see the bottom to the middle to the top of the tree, that falls on your retina, such that the spatial representation is maintained on the retina. And then when the retina relays that information back to the occipital lobe, it maintains that spatial relation as well within the occipital lobe. So clinicians find the existence of these maps to be important, as focal lesions may interfere with only a specific part of that map, which might produce a specific symptom, such as like losing your vision in only part of the visual world. That can help you to localize a lesion. So if I'm looking out into the world and I see this tree and I notice that the middle part of the tree is missing, then I know that because my spatial preservation is kept in the cortex, I know that the part of the cortex that is representing that missing middle part is likely the part to be damaged. During development, the earliest tracts of nerve fibers appear around the second month of fetal life. Major descending motor tracts appear around the fifth month. Myelination, that sheathing with myelin, which I talked about earlier, it's kind of like that layering of fat around the axons. This myelination of the spinal cord's nerve fibers begins about the middle of fetal life, though some tracts are not completely myelinated for 20 years. The oldest evolutionary tracts, which are common to all animals, myelinate first, whereas the corticospinal tracts myelinate largely during the first and second years after birth. Growing axons are guided to their specified target locations during development of the nervous system by extracellular guidance molecules. These include netrons, which guide axons toward appropriate directions, and semaphorins, which cue axons to deflect from inappropriate regions. So you have these guiding axons that are saying either move towards this region or move away from this region. There are many types of guidance molecules, and each are likely specific for a particular type of axon. These are laid down in gradients of varying concentration. Many parts of the developing nervous system begin with an overabundance of young axons and lose those neurons that do not reach their correct targets through a process of pruning. The peripheral nervous system consists of spinal nerves, cranial nerves, and their associated ganglia, which are groups of nerve cells outside of the CNS. The nerves contain nerve fibers that conduct information either to or from the central nervous system. We say that they are afferent if they are conducting information to the central nervous system, or efferent if they're moving that information away from the central nervous system. Peripheral nerves are connected to the spinal cord via dorsal roots, which are sensory, and ventral roots, which are motor information. So these efferent fibers, which move away from the CNS, are involved in motor function, such as the contraction of muscles or secretion of a gland, and the afferent fibers, which move toward the CNS, usually convey sensory stimuli from the skin, the mucous membranes, and deeper structures. Individual nerves can be injured by compression or physical trauma, resulting in a motor and sensory deficit in the part of the body innervated by that particular nerve. Some systemic illnesses, such as diabetes, or exposure to toxins or drugs that are neurotoxic, can injure nerves through the body, producing a peripheral polyneuropathy. In these cases, the longest nerves, innervating the feet, are affected first. Neuroanatomists tend to think of the brain and the spinal cord in terms of how they appear in slices or sections. So, a really important tool for understanding neuroanatomy is to be able to describe the location in the brain of a specific structure. And one way that we do that is often through the use of understanding planes or slices, and also through directionality. These anatomical directions I've done an episode on in the past, but I'll cover them again here. Oftentimes when talking about neuroanatomical directionality, things can be a little frustrating because some people use certain terms other people don't use, and sometimes one person uses one meaning for a term, but another person uses a different meaning for that same term. But generally speaking, there's an understanding about what these terms mean. And so these terms are all relative, and you only talk about them when comparing one region to another region. For instance, we have the term ventral, sometimes referred to as anterior, which means toward the belly. And when talking about the brain, that oftentimes means down, the bottom of the brain. We have dorsal or posterior, which means toward the backside, also means toward the top of the skull or the top of the head. The reason why ventral and dorsal mean toward the belly and toward the back, but for the brain mean toward the bottom and toward the top, is because humans are bent at a sort of 90 degree angle right at their neck. Most animals, if you were to look at, say, an alligator or a dog, the way that they're set up, the top of their head is facing the same direction as their back, and the bottom of their head is facing the same direction as their belly. But for humans, we're still set up that way anatomically, except that we walk upright and our head is cocked at a 90 degree angle. Sometimes referred to as posterior, which others might use to refer to as the back of the head. We also have superior or cranial, which means on the top of the skull or towards the skull side. We have inferior, which is on the lower side. We have caudal, which literally means at the tail end or the lowermost position. And we have rostral, which is on the forward side or at the nose end. So oftentimes you hear people use the term rostral when they mean anterior, and they also use the term caudal when they mean posterior. Another common term that we use is medial, which means towards the middle, or we might use the term median, which literally means in the middle, the midplane, or sometimes referred to as mid-sagittal, because you'll find it in the center on the sagittal plane. We use the term lateral, which means toward the side or away from the middle, as well as bilateral, which means both sides. We also use the two terms I mentioned earlier, ipsilateral, which means on the same side, and contralateral, which means on the opposite side. So remember, these terms are all relative. You only use them when discussing parts of the brain in relation to one another, or parts of the body in relation to one another. That might make it easier to understand. So I could say that the nose is more anterior than my ear because it's closer to the front. Or I might say my mouth is ventral to my eyebrow because it's lower than my eyebrow. I might say that my nose is medial from my ear, or that my ear is lateral from my nose. I can also say that my left ear is contralateral to my right eyebrow because they're on opposite sides of the body. Or I could say that my right eyebrow is ipsilateral to my right leg because they're on the same side of the body. That's really all I have for today. It's a lot of information. It's very dense. I'm going to encourage you not to feel overwhelmed. If it does seem overwhelming, don't worry. Don't get discouraged. We're going to go through each and every one of these things in much more depth, but this is a basic overview of things that you need to know to get started. I apologize for the information dump. I know it's very dry, but it's necessary to have this stuff down before we move on to other stuff in the future. It does get a lot more fun and a lot more interesting. Again, I want to thank you guys for joining me today. I hope I was able to teach you something that you'll be able to make use of. Thanks again for all your support, and hopefully I'll see you guys soon.